This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Welcome to another episode of Echoes of Dissent, a weekly podcast that explores the events, the movements, the beliefs and the personalities. In short, the why a song of protest, a song of dissent was written and sung, and who created it. We look at its impact at the time and its relevance to today, if any.
My name is Frank Carter, and today we're travelling from a Saudi comedy track that helped shift a country to a flash mob on the streets of Washington, D.C. and the chambers of the United States Senate. And on the way, we have extracts from three tracks this week. No Woman, No Drive by Hicham Fagay. That's from 2013. Quiet by Milk. It's spelt M-I-L-C-K. And Respect, which we will all know from Aretha Franklin. Respect is a timeless demand, of course, for civic recognition, which has a surprising origin. And we also have a calm, self-assured interview from a not-so-fringe Christian nationalist pastor who clearly proposes that women should not have the right to vote. Yes, you heard it. In 2026, we're talking about the pushback against women having the same voting opportunities as men. So, our first track from Saudi Arabia, where women had the legal right to vote in 2015, but there were just a couple of barriers they had to get over to exercise that vote.
No woman, no drive.
The year is 2013, Saudi Arabia, and a musician called Hisham Fege picks up a guitar and records a parody of Bob Marley's No Woman, No Cry. He calls it No Woman, No Drive, and it becomes one of the most watched political satire videos on the internet. The song is funny, brilliantly funny, and that's precisely the point. It was a direct response to the ban on women driving in Saudi Arabia. But it wasn't angry. It was an absurdist comment. It held the contradiction of a country up to the light and let you see right through it. Where women could legally vote in local elections from 2015, but couldn't drive themselves to the polling station and couldn't leave the house without the husband's permission. The medical reason given at the time was that driving endangered a woman's ovaries, putting at risk, of course, future generations of Saudi Arabians. But quite honestly, I'm fairly certain that men's vulnerable bits are a bit closer to the driving seat than women's. But I digress. In 2015, Saudi women voted for the first time in multiple elections. Over 100,000 women registered to vote, compared to more than 1 million male voters. Now, there's a fairly even split of population in most countries. So 100,000 women registered to vote, compared to more than 1 million males. So turnout was low, partly because many women had no independent way to reach the polling places. So in summary, the right to vote existed on paper. They were legally allowed to vote, but without the ability to drive, without independent mobility, without access to the polling station, and of course having to ask permission to leave the house, the formal right was constrained by practical and legal barriers. In 2017, King Salman issued a royal decree lifting the driving ban, and while that change came from many pressures, activism, economics, international scrutiny, songs like No Women, No Drive played their part in making the absurdity undeniable. Humour has a way of crossing cultural and political lines that earnest argument sometimes can't. Now, you might think that Saudi Arabia, very different and far away from our liberal Western democracy, and you'd be right, to a point. But I want to take you now to the United States, because the gap between legal right and realistic opportunity is very much alive there. The legislators and the evangelists are just being a bit more creative when they create the barriers to voting. But when it's all simplified, it just comes down to power. Control freak stuff. Here's the situation. You're an American woman in America. You were born Sarah Jones. You went to school as Sarah Jones. And then in your 20s, you got married. And like most women, you became Sarah Williams. You voted for 30 years as Sarah Williams. Your driver's license says Sarah Williams. Your visa card says Sarah Williams. And now a new piece of legislation comes along and says, to register to vote, you need to prove your citizenship. That means a passport or a birth certificate matching your current legal name. But your birth certificate says Sarah Jones. Welcome to the problem with what's known in the United States as the Save America Act. The state of purpose is preventing non-citizens from voting. Problem that is extraordinarily rare. In a review of more than 2 million registered voters in Utah, there was no non-citizens voting, and there was one that was irregular. So what is the problem with proving who you are? Oh, you would think it's quite reasonable. I think in New Zealand we have some kind of proof to register to vote. It's quite reasonable to prove that you're eligible to vote with quite specific documentation that we all have. Or do we? As mentioned, roughly 84% of American women who marry change their surnames. I imagine it's similar to in New Zealand. That's an estimated 69 million women whose birth certificates no longer match their current legal name. A third of American women, according to the Brennan Center for Justice, lack ready access to any document with their current legal name on it. Let's listen to the second verse of No Women, No Drive. No woman, no drive. I remember when you used to sit in the family car, a backseat. Of course, the driver can take you everywhere. A parody indeed. It was funny for the first time, but very pointed. And of course, it's far, far, far away from us, outside our Western culture, how very different those countries are to us. However, in both cases, in Saudi Arabia at the time, but increasingly so, or quite possibly so, in the United States, the barriers, absolutely very real barriers, placed by legislation that make it harder for many women to vote. A finger pointed to Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, as we spoke last week, Eritrea and the Vatican, surprisingly, and three fingers back at the often self-described beacon of democracy. Now, supporters of the American Save Bill, or Save America Bill, say states can set up processes for name discrepancies. Women can bring a marriage certificate alongside their birth certificate. It's not that hard, so say the supporters. But the bill doesn't specify what additional documents states must accept, and it makes it a federal crime, which is a serious business, for election officials to register anyone without the right paperwork, which means local officials face criminal liability if they make a mistake. But there's no real concrete, specific definition of what the right paperwork is. So the provision for exceptions is, in the words of a Justice Center, very weak. As of late June, the bill has not passed the Senate. But as of late June, President Trump has refused to sign a bill that would make home ownership more affordable until the Senate passes the Save America Act. I mean, what do you say to that? You're speechless, speechless indeed. But here's what matters for our story today. This isn't happening only at the national level. It hasn't got through the Senate, but at state level, it is happening. Florida, South Dakota, Utah, Mississippi, and other states have already enacted similar laws for their state and local elections. This is not the national election, of course, but the state and local ones. In New Hampshire, where a similar law took effect in 2025, that's just last year. We're not talking 1725, 1825, 1925. We're talking about last year. There were immediate reports of married women being turned away from the polls because they didn't have the marriage license on hand. Some came back three times. Some couldn't register at all. Now, let's be absolutely clear. Legally, the women of New Hampshire were not denied the right to vote. Their right was perfectly intact, but practically, bureaucratic barrier, one that falls disproportionately on women, meant some couldn't exercise it. And that's the legal versus lived distinction again. Different country, different century, different laws, different country, a different culture, but the same gap. Barriers making it harder for women to vote. Such attitudes, such giving anyone the runaround for something that I had assumed was so. Such actions, such attitude, giving anyone the runaround for something that I had assumed was so embedded in our culture, is simply control freak stuff. We're going to go through the no women, no drive verse again, because I think this really hits at home, not just for the Middle East, but also for our culture. No woman, no drive. Say, I remember when you used to sit in the family car, but backseat. Over resource, safe and well, so you can make lots and lots of babies. And I'm sure you caught that last bit. And that is a brilliant, brilliant reference, of course, to the medical opinion at the time about it was considered by some medics in, or some doctors in Saudi Arabia, that driving was likely to damage women's ovaries. So, of course, it's, we can't have women driving. It's going to put the future generation of Saudis at risk. I think we'll probably return to something like that later in the program when we consider the Christian extreme fringe Christian nationalist position. But there we go. Thoughts. It's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant thought. Now, returning to America and the Save America Act, it is, at least on the face of it, about paperwork. Its supporters describe it as common sense election security. Certainly not as an attack on women's rights. And I think it's important to take that opinion seriously, even while noting who is actually impacted by the barriers it creates. But there's another strand to push back against women's rights, voting rights as well. And that is much more explicit. And it comes not from the centre of American politics, but from a specific ideological movement, the Christian nationalism. And actually, in fact, a bit of a fringe of the Christian nationalism, which we've discussed in previous episodes of this series. And before we go on, I want to be really clear here. I'm not talking about Christianity. I'm not talking about the millions of Christian voters across, the tens of millions of Christian voters across the political spectrum who support women's rights completely. I'm talking about a specific political ideology that uses Christian language and cherry-picks bits and pieces from the Bible to justify a very different vision of society, one in which the family unit, headed by a man, is the basic political unit of democracy. This 2025 CNN segment on Pastor Doug Wilson, a self-described Christian nationalist based in, get this, in Moscow. Yeah, in Moscow, but Moscow, Idaho, was reposted on social media by United States Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth.
Wilson says in his vision of a Christian society, women as individuals shouldn't be able to vote. His fellow pastors Jared Longshore and Toby Sumter agree.
In my ideal society, we would vote as households. And I would ordinarily be the one that would cast the vote, but I would cast the vote having discussed it with my household.
But what if there's your wife doesn't want to vote for the same person as you?
Right. Well, then that's a great opportunity for a good discussion.
There are some who have gone so far as to say that they want the 19th Amendment repealed.
I would support that.
Just as a point of clarification, the 19th Amendment was the amendment to the American Constitution in 1920 that provided the vote or allowed, granted, allowed, in which women were allowed to vote. For the first time in America. It didn't apply to all women, of course. The American Indians were no longer, well, had not yet been considered citizens. And of course, there were increasing barriers put up for certain sectors, especially the African Americans. But moving on, that clip, so calm, so rational, so confident, so dangerous, and so power hungry. To be clear, there is no legislative pathway to repeal the 19th Amendment. But what these voices represent is something worth noting, the explicit argument that women's suffrage was a mistake. One of Wilson's associates, Pastor Joel Webham, has said publicly that the repeal of the 19th Amendment is not about removing women's rights, but about restoring what he calls the family vote, with the husband voting on behalf of the household. He argues this is the Christian position. It's not about removing women's rights to vote. Oh, sorry, this is my comment here. This is my question. Not about removing women's rights to vote, just removing the legislation that allows them to do so. I don't know how that works inside someone's head. How can you fit that kind of stuff between your ears? I just don't know. Now, I want to resist the urge to simply dismiss this as a fringe. It is, in terms of mainstream American opinion, a fringe position. Most Americans, as mentioned above, most, including most conservative Americans, support women's right to vote. But such voices, as we have just heard, are getting louder in this political moment. And when a cabinet secretary, Secretary of Defense, Peter Hegseth, amplifies them and sends them out and repeats them, that matters. So now I think we go through a bit of a thought experiment. How about we flip this one upside down and say that women are the ones that can have the family vote, and men are relieved of the opportunity? And what if the women's surname became the family name, and men's birth certificates did not match their legal name? Someone is immediately going to say, oh, what about all the single guys, the ones looking after kids on their own, the widowers? And why should men have to get extra documentation to prove who they are? Now let's flip it back again to the extreme Christian nationalist position. What about all those single women, widowers, single mothers, raising families, stay-at-home dads? I will leave that one with you, because there are several increasingly extreme positions among the small but increasingly influential group of evangelists that would align the USA with Afghanistan, Eritrea, and the Vatican, and the 20th century Saudi Arabia. So What we're looking at then is the two-channel pushback on women's rights in 2025 and 26. On one channel, legislation that creates practical barriers, paperwork, name-matching requirements, reduced registration access, which falls disproportionately on women. On the other, a philosophical argument that women's individual votes are illegitimate and that the household should be the unit of democracy and that the 19th Amendment was a historical error. One is bureaucratic, one is ideological, but they point in the same direction. And they remind us why protest music still matters, because when the air gets thin, you need voices that refuse to stay quiet. And we have one coming up right here with the first verse.
No one ever will if I don't say something, if I just lie still. Could I be a monster, scare them all away? If I let them hear what I have to say, I can't keep quiet.
First sung in public on January 21st, 2017, Washington, D.C., the day after the inauguration of, or the first inauguration of Donald Trump. 500,000 people converge on the National Mall for the Women's March. It's one of the largest single-day protests in American history. Somewhere in that crowd, a Los Angeles singer-songwriter named Connie Lim, who performs under the name of Milk, this is capital M-I-L-C-K, has gathered 26 singers from choirs around the country. They rehearsed over Skype. They never performed together in person. And now they find a spot in the crowd and begin to sing a cappella, a song she wrote in 2015. What Milk wrote about became an anthem for every woman who'd been told to know her place, to shut up and smile, to sit properly, to be less. The song didn't directly address voting, but it speaks to the same territory we've been exploring today. The pressure on women to be quiet, to take up less space, to defer. And in 2017, it became the sound of women saying, no, we won't. Which brings me to our third and final song today. And if you're going to talk about women demanding to be heard, demanding to be counted, demanding that their voices matter in the public square, you really do have to end with Aretha Franklin. Respect, written by Otis Redding in 1965 as a song about a working man coming home and wanting his woman to show him some respect. And then Aretha Franklin got hold of it in 67, flipped the perspective completely, added the spelling R-E-S-P-E-C-T, and turned it into one of the most defining anthems of both the civil rights movement and the women's movement. And Otis Redding said she had done a fantastic job. She had improved on his original. That transformation from a man's demand to a woman's assertion is itself a political act. Aretha didn't ask for respect. She announced that she expected it. An extract from Aretha Franklin.
Yeah.
And I think that's where I want to leave us today. Not with anxiety about the SAVE Act, all the household vote pastors, all the various legal and ideological battles that are very much alive right now, but with the reminder that universal suffrage, everyone's right to vote, is not negotiable. Not by birth certificate discrepancy, not by marriage name mismatch, not by a pastor in Idaho who thinks the household should vote as one. The formal right to vote is over a century old in most of the countries you and I live in. But rights, as we've learned through this episode, are not self-maintaining. They require people who notice when the air gets thin, who refuse to keep quiet, who stand shoulder to shoulder and insist on being counted. Today's episode brought you No Woman, No Drive, Quiet and Respect. This has been Echoes of Dissent, Shoulder to Shoulder. I'm Frank Carter. You can find this episode as a podcast through freeafm.org.nz, accessmedia.nz, and your go-to podcast platform. Next week, freedom of conscience is more than freedom of religion. It is the right to believe, to doubt, to change your mind, to follow your convictions, and to refuse to surrender your moral judgment to the state, a church, a political movement, or the crowd. Until next week, keep the music loud and the voices louder. Bye.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.